This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 62. Proudly brought to you in association with Archover, Smart Pension, and Synchron. I'm delighted to be joined on the show today, once again by Ridian Lewis, CEO at RateSetter, to talk about the ultra-hot topic of provision funds in P2P. Ridian was on the show in the early days back in LFP 019, an episode talking about P2P beyond the metaphors. That's a good theme for today on a narrower topic, as all too often when one reads about provision funds, it's metaphorical. In practice, as with most of FS, one really needs to get the metaphorical whiteboard out and draw some diagrams and do a bit of arithmetic to make it real. Let's provide some context first. RateSetter was formed in 2009 and has accumulated an amazing 300,000 customers on both sides of the equation, with an incredible 250,000 people on the platform right now, and have lent an amazing total of £1.5 billion, with no lender ever losing a penny of interest or capital over that period. So that's a phenomenal achievement. Very, very, very few fintechs will ever manage to better that. But like growing up, there were growth pains along the way. RateSetter has somewhat been the P2P of choice for taking potshots at this year for the FT Alphaville column and the impressive Kadeem Schuber, who seems to do more research than most. What are euphemistically described perhaps as missteps around self-investment of provision funds, not publishing future loan losses, and rebasing how the provision fund excess is calculated, came in something of a flurry, and even generous if sceptical folks like myself started to raise an eyebrow. Not to let Ridian off my own chance of bowling some short-pitched balls at him, but I suspect strategically that a lot of that is around the growing pains of a company going through a phase change. Certainly at Lendit these days, the leading platforms tend to be ever more anodyne, no more t-shirts, no more off-the-cuff stuff that might be grabbed by reporters, all a little dull. But behind all this is the need to change. Did RateSetter, or for that matter you and I, get everything right in 2009, or for that matter every year since, or do they and we all need to keep changing in the light of experience and further thought? Let's briefly mention provision funds. Certainly I was the first amongst the wise folks that I know to raise the issue of hard-fail provision funds versus soft-fail provision funds. Indeed, some clever folks told me I was completely wrong, and I recall cutting and pasting part of the terms and conditions from RateSetter's website and emailing them. Rather like insightful journalism, the not-secret secret of success in research, and a lot of business, and indeed life, is simply to do more or better homework. So very briefly, a soft-fail provision fund, to use my terms, is like a platform having a piggy bank, into which it puts a few pence on every deal. If lenders' loans are impaired, that piggy bank is ready to subsidise them. But when and if the piggy bank runs out, the platform says, sorry guys, no more funds in the piggy bank to subsidise your loss, over to you. What I call a hard fail model in contrast, which off the top of my head RateSetter is the only big user of, when it runs out of money in the piggy bank, pools all the investors' assets together in order to spread the losses evenly across them. And this is a big phase change. It's like going from water to ice. It's always been a concern of mine, if only because over 30 years in FS has shown me time and time again in different markets that the impossible is always happening. No amount of whiteboard ink, no amount of arithmetic will ever save us all from the future. So let's dive into this. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Ridian, thanks for joining me today.
Hi Mike, very good to be on.
So we're talking, just to get going, about surviving challenging times, and when I was walking through your reception today, I was recalling Winston Churchill. The reason I was recalling Winston Churchill was he had some saying that when you can greet success and failure like the imposters they truly are, or something, and I can't actually remember the rest of the saying. But I'd noticed that in 2015, you won the accolade of FinTech Man of the Year. So no doubt you were feeling sort of wonderful and looking smiley face in the mirror when you were shaving in the morning. And then before you know it, you go from sort of smiley face in the shaving mirror in the morning to all the flak coming in and pot shots around your wings. So how are the ups and downs of sort of nearing sort of late teenagerdom or whatever you are in fintech these days, or P2P?
The expression, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. And it's important to go for these, and not least internally, because people tend to bond better when...
in a foxhole together.
In a foxhole. And they look at each other and they think, do we want to continue doing this? And if they come out of the foxhole together, then there's actually quite a strong bond. And I think that setting up a company and getting going is actually quite easy. It's the kind of phases where...
So hang on, just pressing pause there. That makes it sound like, at the time, if I was going back 8 years, I'd say, oh, this is really easy setting up the company, so you don't know what you're talking about. This is really tough.
Short
it's a
memory.
Bit like having, it's a bit, exactly, it's a bit like having kids. By the time you've got teenage daughters, or late teenage daughters as I have, you go, oh my God, the baby bit, that was really easy. But if you took me back to the baby bit, I'd say, the baby bit, that's really tough.
That's probably right. And, you know, one forgets all the hard times one's been through. But, you know, I think changing gear in businesses is the difficult bit. And I guess changing gear from to naught to one, i.e. just opening the door on the first day is difficult. And then it kind of, there's a period where you just kind of turn the wheel a bit, and then actually changing gear again is difficult. And obviously to get to a business of scale and relevance, which we need to become.
I would say actually you are of relevance now. I mean, 250,000 people is a lot of people. It's not 25, it's 250,000.
I know, and it's accumulated pretty quickly, and it's accumulating every month. And we've from day one kind of focused on the consumer, the retail customer, both on the investor and borrower side, and it's beginning to work.
And in your recent talk, I think you said that you're the largest in terms of retail P2P, and that may well be retail fintech as a whole, actually, in London, off the top of my head.
Possibly.
Unless something like TransferWise has got more. Yeah. But I don't know what a customer is, because it's just people who do the odd transaction. I mean, people on your platform tend to be sitting there lending and borrowing.
Yes, I mean, the thing is, it's worth picking it apart a little bit. One thing about our business is that we've always had confidence in, it's that it's a customer business, because people will stay with you. There are many great fintechs that are more transactional, and the way we see it is the retail investors, if you treat them well and give them good value, they could stay with you for a very long time. And we're seeing that. Got great repeat rates and reinvestment rates and great loyalty, effectively. And then the borrower side is more transactional. And actually, just to break down the 250,000 people, it's about 40,000 people investing, 210,000 people borrowing. The reason why the numbers are so impressive, it's worth, you know, being open about, is we did an arrangement with a company called GiftGaff, and so that's bringing on board a lot of customers.
Mobile phones for people who don't know about it.
Exactly. And they are borrowing small amounts of money for their iPhones and Samsungs and so forth.
Hopefully not for the Samsung Galaxy Note 7s.
I was about to say, otherwise we get a lot of returns.
Fires.
Yeah, fires. Fire sales. That's bringing on a lot of customers, and they are a demographic that is in their 20s at this stage, but will grow, and they're being exposed to the rate-setter brand every day.
And how does that work? I finally get fed up with whatever sort of mobile phone provider now, and like most of us, after a few decades, you've done the rounds of them all, and another one seduces you, and you go there, and then after a while you get poor service, and you move on. So I walk out of here today, I go into a GiftGaff shop or whatever, I buy a GiftGaff phone or whatever it actually amounts to. So, and the guy said, have you got any money? I said, no, I'm just a poor podcaster. He said, oh, we can do some sort of finance terms for you, sir. Would I just see a finance terms, or would he say, proudly provided by RateSetter?
Yes, I mean, firstly, they don't have shops, it's all online, and they're very proudly a low-cost provider. That's how they've kind of appealed to the millennial generation. And yeah, you go onto the GiftGaff website and you go through a journey, and you either airtime only, or you can airtime plus phone. And if you want to buy a phone, there's a finance option of paying over 24 months, and you go down a journey, which is predominantly branded GiftGaff, but it's clear that there's a provider of the finance, which is RateSetter, and then it'll details like the direct debit each month is collected by RateSetter on behalf of GiftGaff. So there is exposure. The customer is aware that it is RateSetter providing a service to GiftGaff. So that's bringing on a big customer base.
A small borrower, hence the ratio you're talking about. And it's also, I think you were pretty much ahead of the times, because I think that deal was ongoing when we spoke, whenever it was a couple of years ago, and your former offices were now sitting in the heart of the city in London, which is very appropriate given how the business is going. But it's what I remember Chris Reach from iWalker, the direct lenders, called, you know, finance at the point of need. Rather than going to a website to do your finance bit. Well, actually, for most people, they're more interested in, for the sake of argument, buying a house or getting a phone. And the finance is kind of the bit that plugs in around the back.
It's the enabler. I mean, I think finance is best, or credit is best, when it's bought for a purpose, not just for the sake of having money in your account. So, you know, it should be bought, not sold, credit. And it's about the point of sale, or when people need it, and how it enables them to get something they want.
So coming back to the challenging times point, because I'm just sort of thinking, wearing my sort of human being hat, as I do all too rarely, that of the 3,500 people listening to this show, probably there's no doubt a number of them going through sort of challenging times in their life at the moment, you know, ups and downs and things looking very bleak and very difficult. So, I mean, just as a human being yourself, what have you found the best way to cope in these circumstances is, when sometimes you think, oh God, I've got to get out of bed this morning kind of stuff, you know?
We've always had confidence in our model and our business, and we're quite long-termist. Well, we are long-termist. And if we make a mistake, I think we're quite open about putting up our hand and saying, sorry, that was actually the wrong call at that juncture in the business.
Yes.
And, you know, people talk in startups about pivoting. You hear that a lot. I mean, we've pivoted a little bit. We've done lots of little pivots to try and optimize our product. We haven't done massive pivots. We've basically remained true to what we set out to do, which is build a big customer base and give the retail investor and borrower a good deal. So we're quite open. And the other thing I'd say is that some of the articles that have come out, we've admired them for their scrutiny. We voluntarily put all the data out there. If people can be bothered to look at it and scrutinise it, well, well done then. And one of them was related to a cohort of lending in 2014, which may or may not, what we call, overspend what was put into the provision fund in that single year. As I say, it's not certain that it will overspend. And if anything, that looked kind of problematical, but actually people then realised, well, that's just one year, and there are other years where the lending has performed well. So it's actually reinforced one of, in our eyes, one of the advantages of the provision fund is that it can cross-subsidise across cohorts.
We'll come to the provision fund in a minute because that's very pertinent. But again, just mentioning the Lendit as it was just this week, I think people who are interested in this stuff can look at Rupert Taylor's talk from AltFind Data, where he was looking at the performances of the various funds and all this kind of stuff and what might happen going forward. And one of the points that he makes, which of course is a very good one, I've seen this for decades as a banker, is just take any bank, any bank's loan book. It's a bit like school. Some years in school, the teachers say, oh, year 11, God, they're a nightmare. Yeah. And year 10, we love them. And year 13, an average is an average of the ups and the downs. You can't have an average where everybody's above average. So all of our cohorts have been above average. It isn't true. Some of the cohorts won't be as good as average. And the most important thing is to learn from those cohorts and sort of iterate going forwards.
Yeah, I mean, we expect 2016 to be a lot better than the previous cohorts because we've learnt and we've brought more skills into the business, etc. The other thing is, it's just blindingly obvious, but people just perhaps underestimate it, is that being a startup lending business is unbelievably perilous.
Yes.
Because you are prey to negative selection, and it's very difficult to fight into the lending market and get a position. So with each year that goes by, we are beginning to see better opportunities. And that's just by dint of kind of being there.
I spoke to another CEO, of course, off record this week, and I said to him, I said, well, how are you guys doing? Oh, it was all fine, blah, blah, blah. And I said, what happened to you lot? Because you had this reputation of being pretty promiscuous in the beginning. You sort of kind of lend to anybody kind of stuff, you know, crazy people at crazy rates. And he said, well, we had to do that to get going because you can't go to the cream. You've got to wait till you rise to the top. He said, well, actually, we're moving on from that kind of business now and moving to more, in my words, sane.
Yeah, it's a balance. And also, I mean, the way we look at it is that in the end, Rate Setter has to work for its customers, for its staff, for its shareholders, and for the provision fund. These are the four stakeholders. And at any one time, there's going to be different pressures. So for example, in the early days, sometimes with businesses in fintech, there's enormous pressures to grow. When the venture capital money's flying around, you've got to hold your nerve sometimes and grow at the right pace at the right time. Because you can grow very well to please shareholders, but that's probably going to compromise on risk or compromise on culture within the firm because you're changing too quickly. Equally, if you don't grow fast enough and you don't try and take on a bit of risk, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yes.
So it's a balance.
Exactly. It's a bit like a sort of flight path. You're always going to be above or below the optimal line. And again, looking at the industry as a whole, I think it's relatively easy to see the years where it sort of put the foot in the accelerator too much and the years where it actually took it off and coasted a little bit. So this year, there's quite a lot of coasting going on. And, you know, arguably late 14, the early last year, after Lending Club was floated, you know, there was a lot of pressure in the UK to actually put the foot on the accelerator. So the inevitable happens. And I think just finishing off this point about challenging times, I like your point about from a business perspective, you need a vision. You can re-examine the vision and you can sort of, as you say, in terms of who's in the foxhole, decide whether actually you're up for this or you're not up for it. And if you're not up for it, that's fine. Just go and find a different sort of game to play, as it were. But if you are up for it, then you have to press on through it. And I think, for, you know, from just from the personal perspective, for those listening having challenging times, using a cricketing analogy, which may work with about two-thirds of the audience and not with the other third, but you have to change it, is that, you know, in terms of bowling, you know, you watch a cricket match and a bowler can be bowling really well all afternoon and get no wickets whatsoever. And the most important thing is to keep bowling your line and your length. Of course, you can ask other people and say, well, am I bowling okay? Or no, and then you listen to their feedback and maybe you adjust it. But actually, if you're convinced and, you know, you're told by your chums that they're convinced as well, then actually often it's really just one of these periods where things are going sideways, and before you know it, actually results start coming in life, you know. And it can be as simple as, look, I want to have a happy relationship and the current one isn't. Well, either you try and improve it and if you can't, well, then something else, and you can have a period where you've got no relationship. But that's all part of the process of getting to where you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your analogy of flying, they say that, you know, when a plane takes off to a destination, it is never perfectly on course.
Yes.
But it knows its destination.
Exactly. Very well put. Right. So away from aeroplanes. So let's get into the provision fund then, Bridian. So maybe you can explain without the whiteboard, simply and clearly as you can, using a little bit of arithmetic if you like, precisely what your provision fund is and how it works. I don't want to sort of dig into all your numbers which are confidential or something like that, but for the sake of argument, let's say I put £100 in, this is my arithmetic, and let's say you take out 2% in fees and you put 3% in the provision fund or something like that from that loan in the piggy bank. So how does the provision fund add up over time and how do you calculate these threes and things?
Absolutely. So let me start out from what does a rate setter borrower pay? He pays three things, he or she. The interest directly to the lender, a fee to us, rate setter as a business, and then a fee into the provision fund. So they pay three things that together make up their APR, their total cost of borrowing. And the fee that goes into the provision fund is variable in that it is risk rated. So it can be from, let's say, 0.3% to, let's say, 5%.
Or a podcaster like me, you'd probably want to charge 30%.
That's assuming you get approved.
No, I wouldn't get through.
So that is where the risk rating comes in. A lot of peer-to-peer platforms talk about their risk ratings, A, B, C, D, E. RateSetter has those. It just has them in the form of how it prices the money into the provision fund or how it prices the risk. It just does it at the back end as opposed to visibly at the front end. So that money then goes into the provision fund, paid directly by the borrower, and accumulates, and then in the event of a missed payment or a default, the lender, who happens to be matched with that borrower, is recompensed in that the provision fund takes on that loan, and then that loan effectively is then chased down by the provision fund, and the lender is at that point made whole, and their money is returned to their account, and they can either reinvest it or withdraw it or whatever. So when RateSetter says no lender has ever lost a penny, we have had bad debt, but it has always been absorbed by the provision fund.
So the piggy bank has always been big enough to cover any impairment by lenders who don't pay the interest or the capital back.
Correct. So that's how it works in principle. Then in kind of the next level down in terms of detail, we obviously, for every £100 comes into the provision fund, the way we manage it and think about it is that we try and make sure that less than £100 is spent on bad debt. And we measure this both in individual cohorts of lendings, years of lending, and equally across the whole book. So if, let's take a year like 2015, if £100 was put into the provision fund in that year, from borrowers that year, we would hope to spend £80 to £90 of that £100.
And retain the surplus.
And the surplus can be retained for years where we get it slightly wrong.
Yes. So it's like, metaphorically speaking, but it's like an insurance fund. So a car insurer, some years, will lose money on the car insurance in terms of premiums coming out and how much they pay. But they've got a big piggy bank in the back with all the retained earnings and profits from previous years, which helps smooth this out.
Correct. It's a smoothing process. Yes, it's like an form of insurance. The difference is an insurance company looks you in the eye and guarantees to pay you. As you know, the rate setter system works on the basis of no guarantees. It's like best efforts. It's like, here's the provision fund. You can see how much is in it. You can see our best estimates of what the losses are going to be. That produces a coverage ratio, which we'll perhaps come onto in a minute. And if we're wrong and the provision fund turns out not to be big enough, you will be exposed to losses. Whereas an insurance company cannot say that and will not say that. Now, that's a whole other subject of whether they're actually allowed to present risk as safety, rather. Yeah. We're very unbelievably upfront and say, best efforts, we'll always try and make sure that you're never exposed to any losses. But we can't guarantee it. The other thing about the provision fund, just while I think about it, is that it offers our investors very good diversification, a very efficient diversification, because you are effectively
exposed to all the credit on the other side.
Correct.
If you buy a loan through, let's say you're crazy and you buy one loan through a marketplace lender, yeah, that loan will perform well or badly, or something in the middle perhaps. and you're exposed to all that. Whereas if you're investing through yourselves, then almost like auto-diversification.
You get auto-diversification across the whole
loan. Across the whole loan.
That's the effect of the provision fund. And we think that that's actually a strength.
And this model has sometimes been described as kind of a mutual fund model in a way. And if you bung money in a mutual fund, you get exposed to the average thing in the mutual fund.
Yes, I mean, technically it's not.
Of course, and regulatory capital and blah, blah, blah. Not capital, but anyway, regulation, different regulations.
Yes, and technically just it's not, but actually the effect in the real world is similar. And we see that as a strength. You mentioned at the top of the programme that we're the only big user of our model. It actually transpires, if you look at some other platforms, theirs is precisely the same as RateSetter.
Oh, that's very interesting, actually. So it serves me right for my hubris and my self-congratulation at the start of the show where I said I dug deeper, because obviously I didn't dig deep enough in all the details. I shall go back and dig again.
So that diversification is a strength, and also it allows people to lend quite quickly.
Okay, I get that bit. So before we come back to the nature of hard and soft and whether everybody's hard or soft or flaccid or whatever, let's just talk about coverage ratio. I was going to say coverage ratio, but I've noticed that language these days is changing to coverage ratios. So first, let's just explain what you historically have meant by coverage ratio, and now what is meant by the fact the industry starts mentioning a couple of coverage ratios.
Yeah, so the way we've run it for 6 years is that on the top of the equation you have how much does the provision have.
So the piggy bank has got £110 in it, for example.
And then the denominator is what is our best estimates of the losses that we expect to incur from the loans outstanding.
Right, so for example, if that best estimate is 100 quid and the piggy bank's got 110, then the coverage ratio is 1.1.
Correct.
And actually yours is whatever, 1.24?
Yes, it's about it's just over 1.25.
I.e., for the total avoidance of doubt, you've got 25% more money in your piggy bank than you think you will need on your best estimate.
Correct. And the most efficient system in the world would just have 1x coverage. It would have a perfect coverage. It would just say, all you need to set aside is what you expect to lose.
There is this thing, which is that the future's a bit unknown, so you always need one for the pot.
And we're doing that to just give people a little bit of a buffer. We're not seeking to, as we've discussed elsewhere, we're not seeking for complete and utter certainty, but we are giving a pretty high margin of error to our system.
Exactly. So, almost complete and utter certainty would be, for the sake of argument, your piggy bank has got 10 times in what you might think you ever cover, because then your margin for error is massive. And your risk guys would have had to got it not slightly wrong, but just humongously wrong or something like that.
Absolutely. And were it 10 times,
the cost for the borrower would be semi-infinite and there wouldn't be a business there.
There wouldn't be a business there because the cost of the borrower would be very high. Or indeed, the cost of the lender, what the lenders would be earning would be nothing.
Okay, so in terms of coverage ratios then, what is the interest coverage ratio and what is the capital coverage ratio?
So at the moment we've always managed it to this, what we call coverage ratio. That is the ratio of how much your capital and interest is covered. And how safe is your getting all of your interest?
So just to be clear again, so I've put my 100 quid in, and for the sake of argument, I'm getting 5% return or whatever for sake of 5 years. So actually I should be getting £125 back if that borrower pays through. It's quite hard without a whiteboard. So I'm expecting to get £125 back, and you've got enough coverage to ensure that I'll get £125 back if it goes to term. You're trying to cover my capital repayment at the end and my interest payments along the way.
That's correct. And we're saying that any coverage ratio as it's currently configured of above one means that you will definitely get that £125.
Or rather, to take the word out of your mouth, you are extremely likely. You don't like definite. If things turn out as you expect in your calculations.
Correct. But one of the things we get asked a lot, and it's completely natural, and I think that this is one of the big outstanding questions in peer-to-peer lending, that once it's overcome, we'll see this industry go mainstream. And it's a completely valid question because we're all humans and we fear the future in many respects, or unless you've proven your ability to handle it, is what happens in a downturn. And we recognise that our provision fund is just a best estimate, and we seek to make sure that best estimate factors in macroeconomics. We've increased our expected loss after Brexit, for example. But in the event that we're wrong, that doesn't mean that Armageddon breaks out, because actually, if you consider the amount of interest that the loans are paying and how much that provides as a second buffer before people will actually lose their money, which of course is what people fear in life.
So for example, going back to my simple model, I've put 100 quid into the platform. I'm expecting to get 25 interests over the years. But what I really care about, and actually I think this very much in equity market terms, and everybody does, always looking at book cost. What I really care about is definitely getting my 100 quid back. I mean, it was my 100 quid in the first place, and I've given it to you, you know.
Yeah.
So almost my real worst case scenario is not, oh dear, in the last year I only got 4% interest, not 5. That doesn't really matter to me emotionally so much. But if I end up getting less than I gave you in the first place, that almost feels like more of a quotes loss than if the interest is slightly lower than it was going to be.
Yes, well, that's how humans work.
That's the mentality. Because it's my money, it's come out of my pocket, it's come out of my bank account, I've given it to you, and if in the worst case I get my own money back, well, I could have put it somewhere else and made something, but actually I didn't lose something.
So what we're saying, and we haven't actually announced this today, but we're working up on this, and we will be talking about this in the coming weeks or month or so, is that we want to give people assurance that it's not a case of them getting all their interest on RateSetter or just losing everything. Actually, they are spread over a huge collection of loans. One would have to burn through quite a lot of interest before they start losing capital. And that actually, while their interest is covered by, let's say, 1.25 times, their capital is covered by a ratio much higher.
Much, much higher as well. Not like 1.26.
No, exactly. So three times.
Yes.
So people can then begin to think, well, actually, this is not no risk, but it's pretty low risk. I think the way that Provision Fund has been presented up to now, it comes across, as you put it, hard fail. We would put it across as a bit too binary. It's either
yes. It's
all going great or it's all a disaster.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, the reality is something in the middle.
Right, okay. Well, let's get on to that bit then, because I think that's always been the concern. And coming back to some of these articles and all these kind of things, and I think it's one reason that RateSetter has attracted the pot shots in something of a downturn in terms of inflows of the industry, even if it hasn't had difficult economic circumstances yet, which is that the perception, please feel free to correct me, the perception is that in the likes of a Zopa provision fund, if things don't turn out as they expect, if they have two or three bad years in a row or something like that, the piggy bank might run out, at which point piggy bank and Zopa say, oh, sorry, guys, we can't subsidise your interest losses or your capital losses. You know, I hope it works okay. We're going to do the best we can. But the perception or reality or whatever it is has always been, as you say, this binary thing, which is that in the RateSetter case, literally $1 more loss can flip you between being a sort of platform with 250,000 to something which is almost like in a wind-down event where all those people get pooled and, you know, that kind of book is running down.
So we recognise that.
And this is the binary. I like your word, binary.
It's too binary yes. In perception, if not in reality. And so we have done a lot of work to think about what works best for all our stakeholders, if you like, i.e. our investors, our borrowers, us as a company, and just the general perception of peer-to-peer lending, actually, because that's another stakeholder we've always got. Just to give the sense that actually this is quite a sensible, low risk, not no risk, but low risk investment, because it's spread over thousands and thousands and thousands of loans, and it's not a binary outcome. And that the chance of you actually losing money is statistically becoming very remote.
Yes, and I think, again, just to contextualise this for people. So on the one hand, I'm sure there are plenty of people listening who are interested in this, and they're going to be a little frustrated now, because actually what they'd really like to know is all the details of where you're going to get when your internal processes walk through. Having said that, from your perspective, RateSetter earlier, rightly or wrongly, has got flack for, as it were, thinking aloud in public. So I feel you guys can be excused
yeah.
for the opposite inevitable criticism, which is, oh, those guys keep it all to themselves until they've completely worked it out. Well, I think, hello, Kadeem, if you're listening, you can't have it both ways. You know, either people need to work out something and give an announcement, which then doesn't change, or they do these micro tacks, as you said. But I think, just to be clear in terms of what you are saying to people at the moment, which is that you recognise the binary nature of the model you've had to date. You've been reflecting deeply for some time and having internal conversations and processes around how that could be evolved, using my hard and soft language, in a slightly softer, a less binary direction, and working around these concepts of interest coverage and of principal coverage. And obviously, there's a whole lot of lawyers to be consulted and a whole bunch of stuff which all needs lining up to evolve your model in the appropriate direction. As you say, for all the lenders, the borrowers, the provision fund, your equity investors in the business, and as you say, the fintech community at large. I mean, I was on Peter Renton's LendIt podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I think one of the questions he asked me was around, you know, hard provision funds. This isn't a model which is particularly sort of taken on, and, you know, do I see that as a sort of risk in London and all this kind of thing? And so I spoke a little bit. So actually, it's not even just in the UK. It is something that sort of attracts international attention. And again, I think that, you know, Everybody needs to evolve. If we don't change, then the whole thing's static. The nature of fintech, I think, actually can be getting a bit too static in some sectors, and it's getting a bit boring. It needs to keep evolving to become, I mean, you said significant. I think you're very significant at the moment. I don't think, and I said this on the episode with John Kerr, I don't think that the P2P as a whole is macroeconomically significant. If you all disappeared overnight, a lot of people would be really upset and lost all their money. But actually, it wouldn't change GNP or anything like that, whereas if all the banks disappear overnight. So I think, as you say, to get to that next stage, the models, everybody's model, yours, funding circles, OPAs, needs to keep evolving until, like, tuning in ever more precisely to an FM radio, you're getting a really good signal.
I think that's absolutely right, and evolution sensible. And a couple of things what I would say. One is we've learnt to try and communicate this a little bit up front. And it's not because we're secretive or anything like that. It's just because we used to operate at pace. We made decisions and moved on because you recognise you can't just kind of... But we recognise now that we've got a responsibility to be a bit more, you know, considered. So we talk ahead of time. So that's one thing we've learned from a communications perspective. And the other thing is, while we've evolved our business model, without sounding too cheesy, we haven't changed our mission one bit. That's completely constant for 6 years, and I think it will continue to be so, that we're here to give access to the retail investor to this terrific asset class of loans.
And to, as much as possible, spread individuals' risk and lower the risk, so that, for the sake of argument, my mum could come to a platform like yours, not knowing about anything AFS or anything complicated like that, and she will get a rate of return, as opposed to, shall we say, a hedge fund manager who'd perhaps rather go to something like a funding circle and choose the G4s because they're outperforming the C9s this year and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very valid model in itself and powerful. We've just chosen as a business to go down the slightly sort of lower risk, lower return retail model, should I say. And in September, we did £72 million worth of lending, 98% of which is funded by retail investors. And it's not to say it's better or worse than any other thing, but it's keeping it simple and true to our overall objective.
Absolutely. And a number of people who are perhaps privately sniggering behind their hands at these sort of, you know, this sort of retail stuff a little while ago, including in America as a whole, actually, but also in the UK, are now not sniggering. That tide goes in very fast and it goes out very fast. The retail tide changes, but much slower. So there's loyalty.
Yeah, and equally, all the talk about diversification of funding is very important. And,
absolutely.
But we've just made a choice at this juncture to keep a focus on retail.
Okay, just to sum up, for the avoidance of doubt, just how I've heard it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, your mission remains unchanged. You've been looking at this binary nature of how the provision fund is operating and worded and presented at the moment, and you've got an internal process, which you're quite a long way through at the moment, with the idea of softening the edge of that binary choice, whilst actually still trying to achieve the objective. And your current expectation is, in the next few weeks, and I'm putting words into your mouth, but certainly by Christmas, quotes unquote, unless there's something out of the blue comes, you'll be in a position to actually dot the I's, cross the T's, and explain precisely how that will work.
Absolutely. And to most users, they won't notice a difference because the objective of the provision fund remains the same, which is to return them every penny of interest and capital.
Exactly, which you've done extremely successfully so far. And as you say, the 2014 cohort was challenging, but I use the analogy with teachers. You don't find any teacher in a school that's got 8 perfect years under it. And, you know, as Rupert was talking about credit markets and all that kind of thing, you know, every cohort is either average, above average, or below average. And that's one of the things that provision funds do, is try and accumulate a little bit for sort of the leaner years. And so far, so good. So just before we wrap up, Ridian, and I'm going to thank you by allowing you to be off the leash and you tell us about interesting things you want without having to answer questions from me. I'd like to thank, as always in my recent tradition of at least two episodes now, I'd like to thank the listeners. Without the listeners, there wouldn't be a podcast. I met lots of you recently at Lendit, and I really appreciate all the love that comes back in this direction and appreciation of what I'm trying to do in terms of sharing with you the very best people in London who've got the best ideas and give you some idea of how to move forward in fintech. I'd also like to thank in particular my brand partners for the podcast, Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 6,000 people, 16 countries and $400 million of revenue. And finally, Archover, smart, simple and transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. So we've done the starter, we've done the main course, we've done the little bit of clearing the table and thanking everybody. So now the dessert course, Ridian, would you like to wave some of your flags for rate setter and the future and this kind of thing?
No, well, I think what's interesting, I mean, just to broaden out, it's becoming abundantly clear who he paid for the financial crisis, and it's been savers.
The people.
People and the savers. And actually, people talk about peer-to-peer lending being a reaction to the credit crisis in the sense that it was able to step into the breach of lack of credit. But now it's almost bailing out the other side, which is to say people are struggling to get income, and it's becoming now front page news. And I think this is going to be a theme that's going to we're going to see more of in the next year or two. Politicians are beginning to wonder that whether that constituency of people should be in some ways given some relief from what's gone on in the last 5 or 6 years.
Absolutely. I think it's personally disgusting, this whole negative interest rate thing. I think it's absolute con by the state. The state, you go make some money, you work hard, the state taxes you a hell of a lot in the first place. What it does with the money, it starts wars and that thing, put that on one side. And then we've got the concept that corporates find negative interest rate bonds or banks find negative interest rates. Well, actually then, the money that you've earned and actually managed to keep away from taxation, then they're going to start taking some of that off you as well. I'm just shocked by the whole thing. I remain shocked and I'm amazed that more people aren't shocked by the whole thing.
So we think that is nearing breaking point. It's been going on for 5 or 6 years, and we think we envisage a shift from kind of monetary policy taking all the slack to maybe sort of fiscal stimulus taking over, and that maybe, you know, I think it'd just be interesting to watch that. But it's given a huge tailwind to peer-to-peer lending. I mean, we saw when the base rate cut occurred that suddenly low interest rates are on the front page of the paper as opposed to just the business section. And we saw a big influx of money because people are suddenly thinking, I've got to do something to earn some return. I can't afford to have it all earning nothing. I think it's a very interesting thing to keep an eye on. And in a way, peer-to-peer lending was seen as a solution to a lack of credit 7 years ago. I wonder whether in the next 3 or 4 years it's going to be seen as a solution to a lack of income in the next 3 or 4 years.
It's interesting. I mean, someone was talking to me this week precisely around the fact that that deal has flipped and maybe fintech slash P2P, market-based lending, in particular on the asset side, will be a necessary part of everybody funding their old age, pensions, school fees, you name it, because you certainly can't fund it with negative interest rates. How do you fund your future? How do you save for your pension?
You have to take a little smidgen of risk to get the return now, and we do see peer-to-peer lending playing a big part in that.
Absolutely. And speaking of someone with decades of experience in risk, I'm very good at judging the past. And it's certainly been true that pretty much for every year, I think every year up to date, it would have been a very good horse racing bet to put your money in a P2P every year. So they've had for many, many years in a row. My gut feel is that the margin, the differential of high quality credits in high quality platforms above bank rates, especially when you compound that margin over a period of time, looks like something that people should really consider strongly at the moment. There'll be some year in the future, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, when the banks will outperform. But I think at the degree of penetration you guys have got, there's still market inefficiency, and I think there's still excess returns to be had by examining this sector. And I'd like to thank you today, Ridgeon, for coming on, addressing some of these things about how you cope with the flak and being very sort of grown up about the fact that you've got a clear mission there and you're evolving the means by which you're getting to your mission. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with a tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.